IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy by the Takshashila Institution. I'm your host, Carl Jason. I'm a program development manager here. And in today's episode, we have a familiar guest, especially those who are longtime listeners of All Things Policy might recollect Karishma Mehrotra, with whom I discussed one of the most brilliant pieces that I ever read that she wrote for 52 website. I'll be sure to link that particular episode to our show notes. But yeah, for those of you who may not have come across Karishma's work in the past, so she's currently a South Asia correspondent for the Washington Post. She was previously a Fulbright Fellow and has written and worked for Radiolab, Wall Street Journal, CNN, The Indian Express, Coal.in, and many more. And she's worked across countries. She's covered elections in rural Pennsylvania to elections in Bihar. And yeah, she's been working on quite a few forward-looking subjects from technology, urbanization, climate. So without no further ado, Karishma, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much. I enjoy being on here.
Yeah. So I think, today's episode is a rather somber development, right? In the wake of the ongoing conflict between Israel and Hamas. And the focus is rather in this part of the world, in India. And this is in the context of Indian workers being recruited by Israel to address a major labor shortage, right, that has come about with because of the conflict and also with Palestinian workers being barred from entering the country. So what I wanted to do was, if you could maybe just zoom out and give us a sense of how the conflict has actually, devastated the labor market in Israel, especially in the construction industry, as you point out in your article, where there's been a loss of almost one third of the workforce from as far as Palestinian workers are concerned. So how dire is the labor market situation in Israel? If you could start off with that.
Yeah, sure. Actually, the labor market situation in Israel before the war was already pretty dire. So the Israeli parliament had already made a special committee on foreign workers. And it's been a big topic of concern and effort within Israel. You know, they have think tanks working on it, lots of building associations. And basically, Israel was already starting to build up these bilateral agreements with different countries to send over workers. That became much, much worse after the war for two reasons. One is that they stopped the work permits for all of the Palestinian workers, which made up, I believe it's a third of the workforce within within Israel. And then they also dealt with the issue of a lot of foreign workers having to leave. So one of the largest groups of foreign workers in Israel are Thai workers. And what happened is during the October 7th attack, Hamas militants killed almost 40 Thai migrant workers and took over 30 hostage. And so out of the 30,000 total Thai workers, 7,000 of them left. And you had a similar scene happen with Nepali workers who are very commonly seen in the nursing and healthcare space within Israel. So whether it's construction, whether it's nursing, they have been dealing with a huge labor issue that was severely, severely worsened after the war. And it was really interesting to look through these special committee hearings because you have stakeholders coming in and saying some really, really desperate stuff about how badly they need workers, and it made it seem like basically construction and a lot of the aspects of the Israeli economy were at a complete standstill. So the desperation is very, very high.
Right. No, it's interesting here because India has known to be a labor outflow market, especially to the Gulf, especially from where I come from, Kerala. I mean, we used to be a big contributor to the Gulf labor market. In your research or in your reportage for this particular piece, was there an existing sort of like network of like say Indian workers in Israel? Has there ever been an experience of Indians migrating to Israel for work, especially in the sectors that they're currently in shortage of? Or is this an entirely new phenomenon that has come about?
Yeah, it's relatively new. You do have Indian workers in Israel. The Israeli embassy told me the number was roughly 16, 17,000, which is a pretty big number for Israel. But there hasn't been a deliberate bilateral agreement between the countries. And one of the contentious issues within Israel is they deal with a lot of like unofficial migration and a lot of exploitation of workers because of that. So one of the big efforts over the past decade or so within Israel is to formalize their migrant workforce. And these bilateral agreements is a big part of that. So in that sense, it's a very new signal of the top heads of the countries coming together and saying, we are going to send over. And this recent bilateral agreement, which was in the summer, was for over 40,000 workers. And that's a pretty big number, because total bilateral agreement migrant workers for Israel last year was even less than that. So that is a new phenomenon in many regards, in the fact that it's the diplomatic relationship that's being shown here as well.
Right. I think one aspect that seems to be unmissable in this developing scenario is there is a clear warming of relations between India and Israel, right? And we see that with you know, the visits by the prime ministers, people to people ties are certainly flourishing between the two countries. So how much of the political, let's say, convergence, if I can call it that, do you think has influenced the decision to, you know, look at the India or look at Indian workers by Israeli companies?
Yeah, I think it's definitely not irrelevant. I think it is a huge part of what we're seeing in terms of this new potential migration path. Sorry, should I repeat that? Did that noise come in?
No, I think we're good. Yeah.
Okay. So it is a big part of this new potential migration path. And the stark change with which India now is such a friend of Israel, and the real change that's happened is that under Narendra Modi's regime, we see a more public embrace of Israel. There has already been a tilt to Israel even before Modi came to power, but you have just this really, really new dramatic shift in how the two countries publicly embrace each other. And I think that is very, very crucial to how India sees its willingness to have this relationship, this labor relationship build. I mean, one thing of note here that I do think is interesting is that it's not black and white. So when I was doing this reporting, it's a sensitive topic for India, because diplomatically, they're still very much for a two-state solution. They don't want to be seen like they're coming in and replacing Palestinian workers. They don't want to seem like this is going against the Palestinian side. And so I actually had a difficult time getting the Indian establishment to open up about it on the record. And while the Israeli side was much more open initially, I think once they noticed that the Indian side is sensitive, they sort of buckled down. So the Israeli side wanted to talk to me, but they are keenly aware of how sensitive India is to this, and that India doesn't want to be seen diplomatically too much towards Israel. So it's a balancing, it's a tightrope that India has to deal with. And as a reporter, you can tell with how open or closed officials are in talking about these developments.
Yeah. Would you also happen to know if the recruitment is specifically for construction within Israel, or does it also include the, let's say, the occupied territories and the other settlements? So, yeah.
It definitely is only Israel for now. And in fact, they even said the areas, at least this is what an Israeli official told me anonymously, that it's not even for the areas in Israel that were attacked on October 7th. So not any of those border areas either. So as of now, this is just for Israel.
Got it. Right. Could you maybe give us a sense of, there are particular states, namely Bihar, UP, Haryana, from where most of the labor is currently being, being considered. What are the expected numbers, how much do you think Israel hopes to bring in?
So one thing to keep in mind is there's two routes happening here, actually. One is a government-led initiative, and the other is sort of the not as government-led initiative, which is like recruiters, so building associations from Israel, et cetera, coming here, talking to private agencies and recruiters themselves, which is a much faster and more seamless process. But so speaking to a lot of the Israeli authorities and the Indian authorities, they're hoping that in the next coming months, they're going to see 10 to 20,000. But overall, like I said, the bilateral agreement says over 40,000. But the timeline of that is what we still have to see. In terms of states that they're thinking about from India, it's actually from everywhere. So it's not just North India. Chennai, I know, is starting up some amount of training. I believe I spoke to someone in Telangana, in Hyderabad. So it's not just the North. And that's because even though there is within India a lot of divergences in wages across the country, of course, when you look at the wage that they're offering in Israel, I think even a South Indian worker is pretty interested. They're offering over 1.5, around 1.5 lakh per month, which is much, much higher than what an average construction worker in India would make.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. In fact, it's probably about 5 to 7x of what an average construction worker would make in India. At this point, Karishma, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back shortly.
Stay tuned to All Things Policy. We'll be right back after a short commercial break.
We are back discussing a very pertinent topic. It's very contextual as well. That's to do with the inflow of Indian workers into Israel in the context of the Hamas-Israel conflict. I've got Karishma here with me. Karishma, one of the most interesting aspects of the article are the claims of religious discrimination, right, in the recruitment process. I know you've not exactly been able to validate this with some of the agencies here in India, but could you just talk a little bit to this for the listeners?
Yeah, I was. There's several YouTube videos online of recruiters talking about their efforts and how workers can apply and what workers should do. And so there was this one recruiter who has so many videos. His name is Amit Kumar. And he's in UP, and he works with this agency called Dynamic Staffing Services. And throughout his videos, he was very clear that Muslim workers cannot apply for this job. Now, of course, all government officials I spoke to and asked about this said there is simply no restriction on Muslim workers. And the agency top management also didn't respond for comment. But so I don't think we can make the claim that in any official regard, there's any religious discrimination. But I think on the ground, these top officials might not have much control of how recruiters go into villages and small towns in a place like UP and how the recruitment process is faring there. I will say, though, it's one recruiter, so I'm not making a broader claim that the entire recruitment process is discriminating. And I think, you know, someone has the time to dig in and see if that's actually happening. I personally didn't. And that's also why the lead of the story is not that. I think if I had found more examples, I think it could have been the main point of the story. But it was an example that I wanted to give of how it might fare throughout India. And one thing to consider is, even if there's not overt discrimination, like the way that Amit Kumar is sort of exemplifying, there very well could be many Muslim workers within India who just simply might not feel comfortable going to Israel. And so, you know, there might be questions we could ask here about the differences that that might bring about.
Yeah, I think that's something to keep a close watch on. Relatedly, how is this recruitment drive actually being perceived in India, Karishma, right? Both among the general public and worker communities. And one of the interesting things that one can glean from, let's say, this particular, rush to sort of go to Israel to take up those jobs, could be a possible downturn in the rural economy, right? And the job growth in some of these states. So what has been your general perception from the ground here in India?
I mean, yeah, workers are very, very excited to go. I spoke to several workers who it wasn't even a second guess that they wanted to apply. Many Indian unions have issued press releases against this initiative. Some say that it signals, quote unquote, complicity with Israel's, quote, ongoing genocidal war against Palestinians. And I did speak to other union heads who very much said, you know, our workers are not going to go into this ongoing war. I think in terms of rural economy and job growth, definitely, I mean, we know that the rural economy has been seeing stagnant growth. I don't know. I mean, this is sort of a counterfactual and a hypothetical, but if let's say the rural economy was still seeing growth, the wage gap is just so large. I mean, it's much more than even these workers would get in the Gulf. So one of the Amit, in fact, Kumar, was telling me that workers, like if he were to rate it, actually it's like, I believe he put Israel and Europe either on the same par or one above the other. And then it was the Gulf. And Europe is difficult to get to as a worker. And so Israel is much, much of a larger sort of aspiration than the Gulf. And I don't know. I think we have to also consider that wage difference is so large that even if we were to be seeing large economic growth within India's rural economy, I still think a lot of workers would still want to go. Workers who were working here at decent wages on Indian standards would still see an opportunity. And the reason I say that is because I didn't get the sense from many workers that they felt that this was particularly dangerous. So maybe the question here is not, it's not just economic growth that's the factor. It's also the idea that workers in India see their lives as anyway in danger. That no matter if they're in India or in Israel, you know, it's to them, it's relatively the same amount of, it's a risk. Yeah. But it's also risky work. And so workers, if you speak to them, they have some story or another of like a close near-death experience, something or another. So I think it's also about our standards of work. and the sort of protections and social protections we have for workers that they don't necessarily see what's happening in Israel as any more of a threat than what is happening here. I thought that was kind of an interesting calculation that they are making as well.
Right. So, I mean, I know we're still like in very early stages of this particular issue. So there is only so much that we can actually delve into. But I think like beyond this immediate labor shortage, do you think there are any long-term plans between Israel and India in your conversations, right, with officials? Of having something, as you mentioned at the start of the podcast, of having bilateral sort of migration pacts, for instance. Like, is that something in the works?
Yeah, I mean, so we have this one bilateral agreement. I think from the Indian side, they would definitely like this initiative to expand beyond manual labor. For example, they'd love more tech cooperation. They would love to have tech companies, Israeli tech companies, come to India. They would love Indian tech workers to be able to go to Israel. So I know for sure from the Indian side, they see this as an opportunity with the demographic dividend we see in India. From an Israeli side, it's not an immediate labor shortage. It's a long-term labor shortage that even if all things change tomorrow with the war, which does not seem likely, we would still see Israel asking India for workers. So I don't see that going away anytime soon. I think this is just the first stage of a much longer process. But I will say it's sort of the process is taking off slowly. And I'd be curious sort of as a follow-up to understand why. Are there issues? I didn't get the sense. I spoke to the that one of the heads of a building association in Israel. And he said, you know, there was no skill issue. He saw many skilled workers when he visited India. And he was quite excited to have workers there. So I'd be curious to see if there'd be any other obstacles or impediments to get the process rolling, or if it becomes pretty seamless and we see that, you know, the amount of workers that Israel wants, they get, because that the dynamic right now is Israel essentially, I wouldn't say begging, but Israel is the one who wants and desperately needs these workers and is asking India to please send them over.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating, especially when you see it in the context of like the burgeoning ties between the two countries. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right in that India does require tech talent from Israel, but that's probably like still some years away. Like India is still negotiating with the UK in its agreement, and that's been taking a while. And I think the contentious issue there has also been skilled immigration, right? So yeah, I think that's definitely something to again like keep a watch on. But Karishma, thank you so much once again for joining the All Things Policy podcast. It's always a pleasure to speak to you and look forward to, you know, your follow-up reports possibly on this. But yeah, do you want to maybe give a shout out to where listeners can find you?
Yeah. First of all, thank you so much, Carl. I really appreciate you inviting me on. I mean, I'm on Twitter. I have a journalist Instagram handle that people can find. And otherwise, all my stories are on The Post. And I know that a lot of people struggle with The Post subscription. So I almost always, unless I forget, share a GIF link of all of my stories on Twitter. Yeah. So you can read them all on Twitter.
Yeah, I think, yeah, you should probably follow her on Twitter because that's how I got to read the article.
Yeah.
Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll be back with another episode.
Thank you. Thanks, Carl.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst. or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.